You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mireya Solis. I'm the Knight Chair in Japan Studies at Brookings, and it's a pleasure to be co-hosting this event today with the U.S.-Japan Research Institute. Today we're going to talk about Japan's trade policy in an era of rising anti-globalism. The launch of an America First trade policy with its embrace of Buy American, Hire American has created a lot of uncertainty in the trade policy world. But there also have been already immediate consequences, and I'm talking about the decision to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This mega trade deal has been at the center, at the core of Japan's trade diplomacy, but also a part of its economic revitalization strategy. So I think the question that we want to address today is how should Japan respond to these developments in American trade policy and politics, in the decision to withdraw from the United States' decision to withdraw from the TPP? What kind of recalibration, if you will, of Japanese trade policy this calls for? And we have terrific set of panelists, an all-star cast, if you will. And I'm going to introduce them very, very briefly and then ask them to start with a very brief opening remark. So I'm going to go in the order in which they're seated. Takashi Terada is professor of international relations at Doshisha University. And he was also before in the faculty of the National University of Singapore and Waseda University. We have next to him Professor Yukiko Fukagawa, who is professor of the School of Political Science and Economics at Waseda University. And before joining Waseda, she worked for JETRO, the Long-Term Credit Bank Research Institute, and Aoyama Gakuin University. Vinny Agarwal is professor of political science and director of the APEC Study Center at the University of California at Berkeley. And Shujiro Urata is dean and professor of economics at the Graduate School of Asia-Pacific Studies at Waseda University and senior research advisor to the president of the Economic Research Institute for ASEAN and East Asia. Shurata has been my mentor for many years, and it's wonderful to be working together in putting the program for this afternoon. So without further ado, I would like to ask you, maybe Shu, you can go first, and I ask them for very concise openers, and then we'll have a moderated discussion, and then we'll bring all of you with your questions. Thank you.
Okay. Mireya, thank you very much for the introduction, and I'd like to thank Brookings for giving me this opportunity to speak about one of my most interested subjects, that is TPP. In my view, although Mr. Trump withdrew the United States from TPP, I think Japan should stick to the TPP. So it could be TPP minus the United States, TPP 11, we may call it. Possibly, if we can invite other countries which showed interest in joining TPP, countries such as South Korea, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Thailand, then we could have maybe TPP 15. And I think it is very important to keep the TPP alive for various reasons, but let me mention two of them. One is that TPP is a very high-quality FTA, free trade agreements. Its coverage comprehensive. In my view, this is the best FTA so far. And it is a shame if we let it die. That's one reason. Another is that Mr. Trump may change his mind. I hope he will. And just in case if he does, we need to maintain or keep the TPP alive. And so these are two of several reasons that I'd like to mention later, maybe, the reason why we should keep TPP alive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Shu. Vini?
Thank you, Mireya. So I'd like to thank Brookings and Mireya for inviting me. Shu and I met each other in 1979, which shows how old we are. at Brookings. So it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to start with some prefatory remarks, since my later comments might be misconstrued. So first, I believe that TPP's passage on the whole has been a good thing, would have been a good thing. Second, I believe that a multilateral approach to trade is better than a bilateral one for a host of reasons that we'll go into later. And third, I generally support an open trading system as a means to achieve global growth through efficiency. Now, having established my liberal internationalist credentials, let me take a contrarian view of the conventional wisdom regarding TPP and trade policy. My overarching point is quite simple. It's an adaptation of the REM song. Trump's trade policy is not the end of the world as we know it. Note that I said trade policy, not his other policies, which we can talk about later on in another forum. Now, let me make a few points here. First, from an American perspective, we should remember that of the 11 other countries in TPP, the United States already has bilateral agreements with six of them: Australia, Canada, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Singapore. And the U.S. has important bilateral FTAs with a non-participant, in this case, Korea. Also, the U.S. is likely to negotiate a bilateral accord with Japan and probably Vietnam farther down the line, as there's more pressure on the Trump administration to do so. So the U.S. has a lot of critical bilateral agreements, although it's true, not with Brunei. Now, second, the supply chain argument about the importance of TPP as a mini-lateral accord is actually quite weak, as John Ravenhill has pointed out in a recent article on global value chains. And particularly without China, supply chains in Asia are much less developed than in Europe. The participation of the larger TPP economies in value chains is also much lower than their European counterparts. So this argument is also not all that credible. Third, the security claim concerning the importance of TPP, and I do teach international relations, was simply an example of hype. First by the Bush administration, as was the P4 became the TPP, and then by the Obama administration. The whole notion that TPP was a critical counterbalancing accord to RCEP was heavily oversold, and in my mind, few believe Secretary of Defense Ashton's claim that passing TPP is as important to me as another aircraft carrier. If that's the case, we have too many aircraft carriers. Fourth, the idea that a China-led RCEP will somehow become a strong 21st century accord, which was the goal of TPP, is believed by only by those who have never met an Indian negotiator. They already are pushing back on any stringent IPR rules, and in short, it ain't happening anytime soon, folks. Fifth, TPP wasn't all that great, if I may differ with Shu. As several analysts have pointed out, the agreement is a step backwards from the May 10, 2007 bipartisan agreement. There are very few bipartisan agreements in Washington on labor environment provisions that should be included in free trade agreements. And in fact, they were included in the Peru agreement and other agreements that the U.S. has negotiated. Sixth, it's pretty clear to me that TPP was strongly pushed by various corporations, but with differing gains and losses, the TPP had very mixed support in the first place. It was hardly a slam dunk, Trump aside, and leaving aside all the other critics. And finally, in my view, it's time for Washington think tank economists to get away from calculating aggregate benefits coming out of different types of trade accords and ignoring the domestic cost of adjustment. It may be time for them to read the international political economy literature on the costs and benefits of trade. I'm glad that economists have suddenly discovered over the last 2 years that trade may actually produce winners and losers. Shock. Here, I must end by pitching the work of our former Berkeley political science student, Ted Alden, who is a Council on Foreign Relations senior fellow, whose book I would recommend to you, Failure to Adjust. Thank you.
Well, Vinny, certainly we'll have a lot to debate today.
Well, thank you, Miriam. Thank you very much for Brookings people for inviting me here. I would like to stress about the strategic values of the Japan-Korea-China FTA once the TPP is somewhat suspended, at least for a while. Japanese government has been keeping a kind of wishful thinking after especially Abe Trump's meeting that we probably succeeded in putting on some life-supporting system on TPP, but we never know. But in terms of supply value chain, that might be a different opinion from Vinny, But we still strongly believe in that we have such a stretched out supply value chain and the whole Asia Pacific during the yen was appreciated. Just covering all the different kinds of economies with common rules and especially accumulated rule of origins might be still a very strategic interest for us. And of course, no one has been paying enough interest to the Japan-Korea-China FTA, but actually RCEP is almost nothing, probably, if compared to the importance of these three trilateral relationships. Maybe ASEAN still remains as a very important production site for Japanese companies, but still we have two very nice portfolio, one in China, one is ASEAN, probably very different relationship with China, Korea. But if we can succeed some kind of common rules, including China's and ROK, that should be quite a benefit for Japanese industries. And actually, both China and ROK desperately need some different interface with Japanese industry. They're just keep hoping to be the hope to be grow based on the hardware manufacturing, but they are rapidly shifting into an Internet of Things industrial 4.0 kind of growth paradigm. So we have a lot of rooms for cooperation, so that might be the political bargain between especially Japan and China. And China's is very much refining the industrial structures, not totally dependent on the hardware manufacturing anymore. And they have some certain advantages because things can be easily deregulated without any political oppositions against it. So China has a very unique interest experiment in fintech, or Internet of Things, and they are all going on. So if we may have some positive cooperation with China, probably that might even try to boost the Japanese economy too. So I think that might be the another aspect of the response after the TPP.
Very interesting. Terada-sensei.
Hi, thanks so much, Mireya, and also Brookings Institutions. My first appearance in Brookings was much later than two guys. It's December 2011. Yes, very recently. Topic was Japan TPP. And I had more than 300 people gathered. That might indicate the America's enthusiasm about Japan's participation in TPP at that time. Now, as you know, a few months later, Prime Minister Abe came to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Obama, in which Japan's participation in TPP was almost decided. And of course, now it's open to the public that both leaders and government had some secret negotiations on automobiles in the US and also Japanese agricultures. And as a result, we can see Japan made huge concessions on both sectors, weak and strong, you know, sectors of Japan. So let me say three things and in this brief presentation. Number one is, of course, TPP is very significant for America's economic and political interests. So my own, you know, the question is, without which U.S., how U.S. actually could survive or, in a sense, promote its Asia-Pacific policy? In my view, trade policy is not purely economic policy. And in a recent period in which politics, security, defense, and economics are all entangled, quite complexly. So I think trade policy is a sort of expansion of foreign policy. This is something which Prime Minister Abe highlighted in his recent meetings with U.S. President Donald Trump. I heard Mr. Abe didn't talk too much about TPP, but instead he highlighted the significance of multilateralism, but not only for the trade and investment, but also more strategic interests. I think that's a sort of the message Japan has kept consistently for long years, even through the negotiation period. So, tariff reactions, rules making, that's of course significant. That suddenly helped American goods, people, and money coming into the region. But Asian, I'm currently living in Singapore on sabbatical, the Asians are more expecting America to stay in the region, not only for economics, but also more strategic and political reasons.
So this is probably the most significant element, I think, the TPP discussion, the debate in the U.S. And already two speakers mentioned about RCEP. Well, it's more East Asian-wide free trade agreement. And Kobe City in Japan is now hosting the 17th and 18th round of RCEP negotiations today. And, well, they're quite different ideas. But my view is, well, RCEP might be useful in terms of putting pressure on the United States to reconsider the Trump administration's trade policy. And in order to do that, well, RCEP negotiations should be continuously going on. But we should probably consider inviting TPP member countries like Mexico, Chile, Canada, Peru. And that would be helping the Japan's interest within the RCEP negotiations, because those countries already signed TPP high-level standards in the negotiations, 100% in 10 years' time, tariff-free, except for Japan. And, of course, rulemakings, environmental standards, et cetera. I think those Pacific Rim countries participating in RCEP would certainly help Japan and Australia, Singapore, those countries hoping to make the RCEP more high-standard regional arrangement. Then, if this kind of arrangement are going on, what would the United States do? I think that would be something which we have to consider in a long term, perspective. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terada Sensei. So I'm going to open up with some questions, and then I'll bring the audience. But let me just start with, the broader context. I think that this has been an extraordinary year. You think about the Brexit vote. You think about the election of Donald Trump and the very different set of ideas behind America First trade policy. And the consequences of these, the fact that longstanding integration project like the European Union has taken a hit, the fact that the United States has divested from a mega trade agreement in the Asia Pacific, that the future of NAFTA is in question, there's a trend here, one that speaks about skepticism about regarding global economic integration. But I would make the case that East Asia actually looks very different, that anti-globalism has not been as potent in that region of the world, and therefore that perhaps there's going to be a shift, and that may be the center of action for where the new liberalizing initiatives may come from. So this is a two-part question. Is why is East Asia more immune, if you will, to this backlash against globalism? And can indeed we expect that the region will become the center of action for people like us that are tracking where the trade liberalizations are going to have more of an impact? So who would like to take a first stab as to how we got here?
Okay, you. Well, I just wanted to make a quick point. I have to disagree with your premise. I spent the time in Singapore every year teaching at a business school there. And 4 years ago, the Singaporeans' PAP party almost, by their standards, lost, which means their vote went down. And it was clear anti-globalization sentiment among the population. They were concerned about too many immigrants. They were concerned about too much open trade. They were concerned about congestion. I'm not an anti-globalist. I'm actually very pro-globalist. But the point is that if you think about Switzerland and if you think about Singapore, these are the two countries that have benefited the most from globalization over the last 150 years. The Swiss were living in little, up in the hills, milking cows, and Singapore was a dump, right? And in, last 45 years, Singapore has become a miraculous place with a higher standard for living than the United States. If there's anti-globalization in those places, something else is happening. And so that's part of Asia. And I think one explanation why there's less anti-globalization in Asia is because, number one, they're quite highly reliant on trade, and two, most of them have authoritarian governments of one form or another.
You know, if you remember how East Asia achieved high economic growth, it's trade and investment. Yeah. Right. And, well, Singapore is a prime example of this. And having said this, there are still barriers to trade and investment in many East Asian countries. And they realize the importance of reducing these barriers so that they can, promote trade and investment, thereby achieving economic growth. I think that's the kind of mentality of the, at least, government people. I agree with you, maybe some groups in any society against, globalism or against trade and investment and liberalization. But overall, maybe because of authoritarian government, but not just because of that, many government officials and government leaders, they believe it is important for them to liberalize trade in order to achieve economic growth. I think that's why we still see some momentum going forward in terms of trade and FDI liberalization in East Asia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My opinion is probably closest to Professor Rada. Asian economies is, there can be a difference between the movement persons and the trade and investment. And Asia has accumulated such a great success based on the opening market and especially opening the foreign direct investment. But in terms of movement of persons, Asia has been relatively conservative. So that's why the anti-globalization starting from the movement of persons seems to be rather kind of immune in Asia. Mm. So I think that's a difference. And Japan is a typical country. Still, it might be a shame, but still, even though we have started suffering from the labor shortage, but the foreign workers are still very minor in Japan. And that's why it can be a kind of rather naive sense against the globalization. Still, we are interested in TPP, just trying to make up the race for the FTA. So, and there's no major opinions trying to go against the TPPs and other FTAs. Mm-hmm. So that might be the Asian situations, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably. If I accepted your premises and if East Asia is immune to the anti-globalization, that may be probably because East Asia is not necessarily highly institutionalized, highly integrated. Again, as I mentioned, TPP would be the first trading arrangement, even to Japan, which had some of the rulemaking like labor and environment. Asian FTA never had this kind of growth. And as an economic community, it was actually said to be completed last year. But, the number of issues which actually left untouched, for example, the tariff reduction, that's fine. But what is the next? It's ASEAN is going to be a customs union, for example. No way, because Singapore needed to raise tax tariffs to create a single, the tariffs. So I think ASEAN is now struggling to find where the ASEAN economic community should go. I think TPP, which penetrating into the ASEAN 10 framework for integration, would be a quite interesting agenda setting. So what I called, probably 1980s, 1990s, we called the ASEAN minus X approach. I think TPP is sort of the embodiment of this kind of stuff. Suddenly, TPP creates the window for the highly integrated framework for integration. It's coming into the region. But this means, the East Asia still are not politically so much influenced by the hard approach to the economic reforms imposed by, the higher standard of the integration. So this is very different from Europe and the North American situations. So, ironically, East Asia is not highly integrated. I think that would be that reason why we are still looking for the more prospects or a broad side of the globalizations through the trade and investment expansions.
Okay. So let me add a comment here. I mean, I don't mean to imply that there are no critics of globalization in East Asia. Far from it. And the critique of globalization is not new either. But it seems to me that we are at a different moment. We seem to be having a very profound questioning of the merits of integration and political action behind it. And Brexit has consequences. Withdrawal from TPP has consequences. And my question is, why we don't seem to see that level of rejection in East Asia? And a couple of things that came to mind, and these are just, speculations, if you will, but I wonder how will you react to them. It seems to me two things. One is that the proposition that trade and national prosperity are linked are not as doubted in East Asia as they seem to be in the West, the industrialized world. And this has to do, I think, with a demonstration effect that is more recent. You think about China and how many millions of people just came out of poverty. But I also think it has to do, for example, about how people perceive very clearly in Japan, for example, the link between economic growth and strategic articulation in the world economy. If you think about demographic trends today, that means that Japanese population is going to drop. And that means that the well-being of the global supply chain and unfettered access to overseas markets is going to be central to Japanese economic dynamism. So I would say that that link is perhaps still more robust. But also, and going back to a comment that you made, Vinny, earlier, also we have to look, I think, at the where this economic grievance is coming from and what governments are doing about it. And it's interesting to know that economic inequality has increased both in Japan and the United States, but the drivers of that inequality is very different. In Japan, actually, has been more of a bottom-up, an increase in the poverty rate. And in the United States is, you know, the stagnation of middle-class income and the top 1% phenomena. But I would make the case again for further discussion that the seeds, perhaps, of populism or of economic grievance in Japan are perhaps being planted today. When you think about the non-regular workers, the fact that you have 40% of Japanese workers that do not have the same path to professional achievement, do not have the same livelihood potential, earning potential, and so forth. So I was just trying to get at what could be different in these two regions. And then let me then pivot to what we do next, if we discuss some of the context. And, you know, clearly all countries in the region are trying to understand, and so are we, what will be the exact operationalization of an American first trade policy? Because there's been a lot of rhetoric, a major movement regarding TPP, but a lot of the rest remains in the air. We don't know exactly, you know, what will be done in terms of border taxes, in terms of punitive tariffs, in terms of Buy American clauses. It remains to be seen. But the political leaders in the region, I think, are paying the cost of U.S. withdrawal. So my question is, I guess, to the Japanese panelists, but Vinny, of course, if you want to venture also something, on what does this do to Prime Minister Abe politically at home? How does he regroup regarding his trade strategy when he had put so much of his political capital on TPP and then the United States politics means that the United States is out of the agreement for the time being? So you're the political science.
Okay, let me say both domestic and foreign policy are relevant. On domestic politics, of course, the most difficult stumbling block to the Japanese trade policy is agriculture. And it was Prime Minister Abe, first time in history, who tried to touch on the reform of the so-called Central Union of Japanese Agriculture, or ZZenchu. And he said, I remember, the one organization in a postal period, nothing changed over half century. So this was sort of appealing point to the public. You know, I think the general public tended to support, you know, Prime Minister Abe's commitment to the agricultural reforms, not on the sort of the tariff and this kind of stuff. But, you know, the political lobby who try to exercise power behind the curtains. I think that would be probably helping the Japanese negotiator in the future to have a better advantage in terms of the negotiations. So without TPP, this kind of reform should be going on. But I think current popularity of Prime Minister Abe, nearly 60%, consistently over the last 3 years, 4 years. This is unprecedented. We've never seen such a popular prime minister in Japanese political history. So that would be probably a basis for Japan or Prime Minister Abe to be more committed to the agricultural reforms, to make Japan's agriculture a strong economic, so strong growth, you know, the source. Foreign policy, again, I still believe TPP should be ratified, as it was, you know, the agreed. But, you know, at the moment, it seems to me there's no way to go. So this is something which I'd like to ask American, you know, the people. How about the role of Congress in which, you know, Republicans are dominating? I heard, you know, tend to support TPP or free trade spirit. And they also support TPP originally. And how, you know, they try to put pressure on the Trump executive, you know, to change sort of the mind on the trade issues that Professor Rado just mentioned, right? So I think the three issues to be probably raised in terms of the promoting revisions or amendment in a TPP, if possible. Of course, one conspicuous element is the shorter period of the medical exclusivity issues. I mean, the biomedical, you know,
product. The biological.
Yeah. This is the most, the contested issues in the TPP negotiations. So, again, I don't know, it's very hard to do it. But however, maybe Prime Minister Abe tried to work and to think about, you know, the possible revisions of TPP to keep it alive. Foreign policy arenas.
Okay, so why don't we're already talking about the what next, you know, plan A was a TPP-12, that was the preferred choice for Japan, both because of the economic impact, but also the geopolitical impact in terms of solidifying the alliance with the United States, finally finding a compromise that works for both sides on these divisive issues about market access, working together to disseminate rules that both countries agree are to their benefit, and they help rejuvenate the trading system. But that's not in the cards right now. And, I've written in the past also saying that Japan actually should be ahead of the pack in promoting a TPP-11. I have seen perhaps more vocal arguments coming from Australia and New Zealand than Japan. But if we can get, a consensus here or not a consensus on whether a TPP-11 makes sense and what would be the strategies to get there, that would be great. So if you want to jump into that discussion.
Well, I already mentioned about TPP, not just 11, but possibly TPP-15, by inviting those countries which are interested in participating in TPP. And coming back to the point about the importance of TPP for Japan, it's not just for Japan, but for other countries as well. You know, if we can enact TPP, for example, for Japan, that would be a big push, that will play a very important role in promoting economic growth to overcome this very disadvantageous position that we are in. Population is declining, aging, savings rate is declining, government debt is, you know, just huge as ever. Under these circumstances, what we need is to achieve economic growth is to promote and improve productivity. Now, how can we improve productivity? We have to do structural reform, policy reform, and we have to open up the market. Mm-hmm. And to achieve these two objectives, TPP or, you know, like FTA, very high-level FTA will be very effective. And that this kind of, I think, prescription applies to other countries, Vietnam, Malaysia. And so I like to argue that TPP-11, TPP-15, be very important for the countries involved. And I agree with you that Japan should, you know, take a maybe more active role in leading this pack. But I assume that Prime Minister spent so much political capital in pushing TPP-12 forward, so maybe he still wants to stick to this TPP-12, but I think it's about time that Japan should look into, you know, possibility of leading this role in TPP-11 or TPP-15, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Other comments on this?
Well, I would agree with Shu. I mean, I think it is useful for Japan to have TPP-11 and TPP-15. I see no reason why they shouldn't pursue that. But there are two points I want to make that are in this context. One is when we think about Asia, we sort of think that Asia pursued some kind of neoliberal model of openness. That's not what happened at all. Asia had aggressive industrial policy of various kinds. They then have been phasing some of that out, but China still has a very aggressive industrial policy. Singapore has a very active industrial policy of various kinds. So these countries are in a somewhat different position than kind of the neoliberal model that we think about. And then when it comes to Japan's main issue, and I'm not a Japan expert, but I know something about Japan, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's nothing stopping Prime Minister Abe from opening up immigration. And I was looking at the Philippine-Japan agreement, and they made it so difficult for nurses to come to Japan. So, I mean, nothing's stopping them. So, okay, fine, if you need to have external pressure, which has always been the excuse that the Japanese have used to try to get any trade liberalization, so be it. But this is not exactly a problem that could not be handled domestically, except for the fact that the Japanese prime ministers have been consistently weak on this issue.
I think one of the crucial differences before and after Abenomics is that now the government is under the very strong pressures for their growth strategies. If we ruin, well, after the quantitative easing, if we fail to continue to grow, Japanese, well, government is the worst heavily debted in the world. So, of course, we have no future at all. So there must be a very strong consensus among the people that opening is the our part of our growth strategies, and we've got to do everything about this. And in terms of other FTA, I think, of course, we put so much political capitals into TPP, but the result is coming back already, because now if you look at the Japanese agriculture, that's the most fastest-growing sector in terms of innovation. So that's the only sector who have invested by young entrepreneurs in their 30s. So I think the market pressure still is very important for Japan. And in terms of the pressure coming out from the other FTAs, I think now Japan is the final stage to have an agreement with EU. And Japan-EU is a kind of mega FTA. And that is a kind of pressure against the U.S. that we should continue this effort. But this is another deadline, political deadline, because the France and German elections is coming near. So whether we'll be able to announce the, at least at the temporary agreement between Japan and the EU is one big issue for us. And the other issues is how to accelerate RCEP, Japan, mm-hmm. ASEAN plus Japan, Korea, China, New Zealand, Australia, India, and how to pin the India still in the negotiation is another issue. So that's the agenda probably between Japan and ASEAN, who's interested to be the driver of the RCEP agreement. So I think we have a lot of rooms to cooperate between ASEAN, and that's another issues against China too, because China wishes to taking Japan into the One Belt, One Road, big cooperation framework, as well as Asian Investment Bank. So we may be able to cooperate with China even against this some very various specific projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very briefly. Well, of course, I support, you know, TPP should be launched as it was originally planned. But if not possible, well, I still prefer the TPP minus USA, TPP 11, mm-hmm. because that's much easier, mm-hmm. you know, because all 11 nations already agreed. But, you know, the United States is very much significant to Japan. So my proposition is TPP minus USA plus US-Japan bilateral FTA. And so that, you know, the US still continue to be engaged in the Asia-Pacific region. And Japan probably can take such kind of role. And given the fact that, you know, Prime Minister Abe has a quite good relationship with U.S. President Trump. So now, you know, the many countries requested Japan to inform, the, you know, Mr. Trump's personality or anything like that. So I think this is sort of the role, new role for Japan to play in carrying the sort of the information about Mr. Trump rather than directly asking the U.S. government to release.
I'm glad you bring up the discussion about a possible U.S.-Japan bilateral trade agreement. Prime Minister Abe was here not long ago, and there was great chemistry, if you will, and I think that the Japan side felt that all the assurances, very important assurances on the security front were given. And on the trade conversation, on the economic conversation, they did not specifically talk about a bilateral trade agreement, but a bilateral economic framework. And I think that Japan is probably trying to understand better what would be the content of such a bilateral if it were to move forward. And there's a lot of discussion in town as to what would be the pros and cons of that negotiation. I'm going to put out my perspective, and then you can shoot it down, but just to get the debate going. I think that it would be harder to achieve a successful outcome in a bilateral trade agreement for a number of reasons. One is that I would imagine that what was achieved in the TPP in terms of the market access and non-tariff measures becomes the reference point for the next round of conversations. And I imagine that Prime Minister Abe would have to go back home and say, I'm going to improve on what was already achieved so that he can justify starting a new negotiation. And the United States will most likely also try to improve its access on agriculture and so forth. So I think that the margin, the room for agreement might be smaller. But also, I also imagine that there might be other issues that now are brought up again on currency manipulation, binding rules on currency manipulation that Japan was not willing to accept in the TPP talk, or even some of the things that we hear officials in, you know, related to the Trump administration talk about. Again, it's not policy yet, but things that would highlight a different approach. Automatic triggers for a renegotiation, for example, using the trade deficit as a measure of success or failure in a trade agreement. All those things I would imagine would be extremely problematic for Japan and other countries. So without knowing first what the American first policy really looks like, I imagine there will be some reluctance on Japan's part to give the green light. But that's my perspective, and I know there are many others out there. So I was wondering, what is your take on the pros and cons and the likelihood of a bilateral U.S. trade agreement in the Trump administration?
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very tough on Prime Minister Abe to reject this proposition if it is given to him. Having said this, you know, I'm an economist. I'm in favor of liberalizing trade regime. I'm in favor of further opening of agriculture sector of Japan. In my view, that will strengthen the Japanese economy, Japanese competitiveness. So I'm all in favor of, you know, having more market opening, which will be maybe asked by the U.S. government or Trump government. Mm-hmm. In order to accept that, we have to get the similar treatment on the part of U.S. Opening up the auto market. So it's, you know, if that can happen, I think it is a very beneficial bilateral, you know, FTA between these two countries. And having said this, one concern that I have is that if they concentrate on just, you know, bilateral FTA, what will be the impact on other countries? Mm-hmm. That may reduce the incentives or interest on the part of the other countries to do a region-wide FTA. So if I were a Prime Minister, I would say, I'd accept your proposition about bilateral FTA with the condition that this is a one step toward, like, TPP-like, you know, region-wide FTA. Mm-hmm. And one more thing, that is, as you tried to point out, this is not a bilateral FTA talk, it's a economic dialogue, mm-hmm. which includes infrastructure. There, Japan can contribute a lot to the U.S. So, you know, we give some infrastructure. So, and then we cannot accept unjustified kind of observations such as, you know, bilateral trade deficit is an indicator to be looked at. So, in other words, we have to be very, Japan should not accept some of the very unreasonable kind of proposition that we may get from the Trump administration. But if we can stick to the basic rules, basic, you know, reasoning, justifiable reasoning of economic matters, then I think we should accept the proposition about economic dialogue and bilateral FTA.
Great. Other views on this?
Here I mainly agree with Shu. And I think it's quite accurate that Japan would benefit from greater trade liberalization, greater opening, given the difficulty domestically in doing it. I disagree on one point, which is that I'm not a wild fan of America First trade policy. I'm one of those old-fashioned WTO supporters, multilateralism is good kind of guys, right? But having said that, in an asymmetrical negotiation between the U.S. and Japan, I find it very hard to believe that the U.S. is not going to get mainly what it wants. And so I think the space for Japan will close very rapidly. I don't think that Japan is in a very good bargaining position, and I don't think Japan has all that many options. So ironically, we're probably more likely to get an agreement, in my view, because of the asymmetry in power. And there's plenty of evidence that there's been the case in U.S. bilateral negotiations, from getting Wrigley chewing gum into Australia despite Australian opposition, and getting sugar excluded and things like that. So the U.S. can actually be a bully, as the EU has been a bully in its negotiations. So in fact, the Japanese are in a much worse situation than TPP, which is why they were fond of TPP in the first place.
But, if I can just interject, I mean, the U.S. and Japan do have a long history of bilateral negotiations. Yeah. And the United States played hardball in many of those. And the issues that Japan did not want to change, they were not changed. I mean, Japan can also play defensive very well. And you could argue...
I mean, you and I read the history differently, right? Textile trade, Japan was forced to have voluntary export restraints. Steel trade, 68, Japan was forced to have export restraints. Television trade, Japan was forced to have export restraints. Automobiles under Reagan, 81, Japan was forced to have restraints.
Yeah,
this
but if
success?
You look at the structural impediments, initiative negotiations, and
the Japanese
reform
are
of
good
business
negotiators,
groups.
And there's a U.S.-Japan alliance, and the context of that was the Cold War. The context now is quite different.
Yes, yes. But, I mean, I'm not sure that necessarily asymmetric power would play one way. And we saw it in the TPP negotiations that the core
I think the one saving grace for Japan is we have some bipolar elements with China. So if the Trump administration is really very anti-Chinese, Japan is now a cog in the big machine, and they can play the same card they did during the Cold War to get concessions. Even they did get some concessions, right? So they can prevent the kind of opening because they can say, well, we're your only ally in Asia, and, you know, the Indians are unreliable, but we are your true ally against the Chinese. So in that sense, they can play the China card against the United States.
Okay, I'll bring the others, and if not, I want to go into the China card. Do you have comments on this discussion, or...
That's fine, go ahead.
So let me just talk a little bit about China, because I do think that we're trying to figure out what is going to be the landscape of trade agreements in the region. We cannot not touch upon what China's role is going to be. And I know that, you know, China has very quickly maneuvered skillfully and made the case that they're going to be now the champions of economic multilateralism in the region. We saw this message in the APEC leaders' meeting, but also with the appearance by President Xi in Davos. And the question that I would like you to address is whether China can indeed play such a role. What are its assets and what are its liabilities in trying to take the mantle of promoting economic multilateralism?
I don't think at the moment China cannot play that kind of role, because China is not ready to open up many of the sectors. Automobiles, for example. So unless they are ready to open up their market, they cannot take a leadership role in, you know, multilateralism. And on the contrary, they are interested in infrastructure. One Belt, One Road initiative, which involves building infrastructure. AIIB, the same. So they are avoiding trade liberalization. And that's what we see in RCEP negotiations. They're hiding kind of behind India to protect their own industry. So again, I don't think China is ready to take this role that you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think China has their own logic, saying that, it doesn't matter, since we are all the developing countries, and it doesn't matter how WTO consistencies exist, because we are backed up with the so-called enhancing rights, so we don't have to copy the advanced countries, a rapid opening, so it's good enough to do whatever we can do. So that seems to be quite popular among the emerging countries who do share the hatred against the Washington consensus in ancient time. So China has been making the best use of this kind of emotions, which is quite common among the emerging countries. So that's why they have strong logic saying that pure liberalizations probably will bring you a lot of chaotic situations, but if we just combine the corporations together with the trade opening, that should be fine, like us, and that's a Chinese campaign. So I think China will continue to do that, and many countries will be attracted by this idea, even including Europeans, who's been having even a greater roles in One Belt, One Road cooperation. So now China seems to be quite desperate about absorbing all the technologies and know-how about managing international organizations and managing the research and accountability making process. And it will take time, but I think China is very much committed to this mission, and it's there continues to do that. Mm-hmm. So the issue is, well, in terms of trade pact, I think now the PM Abe is quite a security guy, and he only takes up the economic issues only when the elections is coming near, and then after the election, he go back to the security logic. So as long as he continues this play, Japan-China FTA still tends to be very much dominated by the security issues. But having said that, economic cooperation and economic interface is a reality. And if you just talk to the Japanese companies, no one say that we won't be able to survive without Chinese market. So I think there should be a certain good balance between the securities and economic values might be the agenda for the sustainabilities of PM Abe's administration.
Right.
Yeah, just wondering the Professor Fukagawa's comment on China-Japan possible integrations. Well, still, but CJK, we call China-Japan-Korea FTA under negotiations rather than bilateral ones. But CJK has already one achievement. Trilateral investment treaty signed in a few years ago. But again, Professor Fukagawa highlighted the political significance of gouging the movement of the such kind of economic cooperation or integration in Northeast Asia. I think at that time, Japan was not governed by LDP. You know, it's a democratic party of Japan, which tended to emphasize the relations with China. So I think the China-Japan bilateral relationship was relatively good at that time. That also had an impact on the economic, you know, the movement, which actually resulted in the trilateral investment, which of course Japan and Korea pushed hard, and China became defensive, but China's defensive posture was changed because of Japan's interest in TPP. So I think without TPP, who actually pleased? It was China, obviously. So I think China capitalized on the period in which, you know, the trade pressure through the TPP or WTO, any other kind of stuff, are missing. I think China would be more inward-looking, although in Xi Jinping's speech highlighted the significance of free trade. But it seems to me China's free trade concept is very different from Japan or Americans, as you can see. And now, the of course, one contested issue was reform of state-owned enterprises. But I heard recently Chinese Communist Party strengthened its control in SOEs, you know, by setting up some of the committees within each company. So how do you know the SOE reforms could be implemented? This would be prerequisite for China to participate in the TPP negotiations. So I think TPP would be sort of the political mechanism which US or Japan can capitalize on moving China towards something which Japan-US prefer. But unfortunately, we lost this kind of the, you know, political weapons. So that's why the we are now negotiating or discussing this kind of forum, it seems to me.
Right. Bini?
Just a quick point. I mean, I think the notion that somehow China would provide leadership of the global economic order the way the United States provided it, with plenty of concessions to other countries, is a classic example of what I would call fake news. Right? This is impossible for me to believe. This is a country that is restrictive in automobiles, that has industrial policy in wind turbines, that has industrial policy in solar. And I had a large number of international students at INSEAD, and they said, well, Vinny, you're so smart. Tell us what industry to go into. I said, very simple. You just read the 5-year plan and stay away from those industries because they're going to wipe you out in those industries. And China has systematically done this. And of course, everybody says, oh, my God, there's surplus capacity, there's inefficiency. Well, that's great. When everybody's wiped out, there's surplus capacity and efficiency. It's called predatory dumping. There's a well-known term for this in economics. People sort of forget that part of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right, so people have been very patient. Let me bring you to the conversation. We're going to have microphones. If you can just wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and ask a very concise question. So, Fred, the first goes to you, but can you bring the microphone?
Fred Bergston from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Question for Shu and a question for Vinny. Shu, you talked positively about a U.S.-Japan bilateral as an alternative to your preferred TPP extended. I agree with you on all that. I think it is clear that Trump wants bilaterals. I mean, he has, in fact, said positively he will do trade agreements, but he wants one by one. He said it in his CPAC speech last week. So why would it be really at all difficult for Japan and Prime Minister Abe to agree with that? We know that the TPP itself was to a large extent a U.S.-Japan FTA. That was the bulk of the economic effect. So why wouldn't it be fairly easy to transpose what was agreed in the TPP into a U.S.-Japan bilateral? And by the way, on one other point you made, the effect on third countries, wouldn't it increase the incentive for the other countries to do a deal with both our countries because of competitive liberalization, as you said, otherwise they're discriminated against? I would have thought it increases their incentive to come on in. And then a sub-question, in your preferred TPP extension, you carefully did not mention bringing China in. Now, I infer that's because you think they're not ready, they wouldn't be able to meet the standards, but I ask you about that. The question to Vinny, your third point in your first comments, you expressed doubts about the foreign policy or national security case for TPP from a U.S. standpoint, but you didn't say why. The whole reason Obama reinserted the U.S. into TPP was foreign policy, national security. It wasn't economics. He had no interest in that. It was when Lee Kuan Yew, among others, said to him, Mr. President, unless you take economic initiatives in Asia, you're turning the whole region over to the Chinese. What's wrong with that argument?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for three difficult questions. To begin with the first one, Japan-U.S. bilateral. What I was going to say is that while many people in Japan, government particularly, are concerned with the fact that U.S. like to begin with the level of agreement that it was reached in the TPP and then go further liberalization, further acceptance on the part of import of rice and so on. So that is why I think Prime Minister Abe hasn't said anything about this U.S.-Japan bilateral FTA. But again, I'm in favor of Japan-U.S. FTA because that may result in further liberalization, which in turn would improve the competitiveness of the Japanese economy. But the reason why Mr. Abe and his colleagues are concerned is that the negotiation begins with the at the level which was agreed upon, and then go further. Further liberalization will be very difficult. About the effects on third country, what I was going to say that the third country may be more interested in joining U.S.-Japan FTA, but what I was trying to say that U.S. and Japan should agree at the beginning that this is not the end, end result. The end result of the bilateral FTA. They should go further after they finish bilateral FTA, or even before finishing bilateral FTA, they should think about inviting or accepting other countries. That's the point I wanted to make. Now, China, as I said in response to Mireya's point, China is not ready to maybe liberalize further to the level that was required for TPP. And in addition, as maybe like Terada-san said, SOE issues. intellectual property issues, environment, labor. There are so many issues that they cannot really accept at the moment. Maybe you know later, 10 years later or 15 years later, when China is successfully achieving economic growth, they may be ready then, but at the moment, they are not ready. So that's why I don't think it's realistic to invite China to be included in TPP.
I think those are an interesting question. I mean, to why did the U.S. decide to pursue TPP? I mean, first is, of course, we often forget this was a sort of a Singapore P4 initiative in the first place, right? And Singapore was very interested in its bilateral agreement from a security perspective, and Singapore has very strong security ties to the United States already. So clearly, Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew is no fool, obviously was no fool, he really understood that the U.S. keeps getting distracted by the Middle East, seems to ignore Asia. So in that sense, I would agree that it started out that way. The problem is that TPP versus RCEP became the game in town. And TPP versus RCEP, and RCEP is the Chinese-led agreement, and this is, well, that's very misleading. RCEP was initiated by ASEAN, the ASEAN plus one countries. Japan was an active participant. India is in it. So this whole idea of seeing everything as a bipolar struggle is what I object to. Second, TPP got taken over by these corporate interests. And I'm not even, and I was still, despite the corporate interests, pushing for TPP. I was still in favor because on the whole, I think it was a good agreement. My point really was, is the end of TPP the great disaster for U.S. security? I think if we say that, that's misleading. I don't think so. I think there are other substitutes. I still, on the whole, would prefer to have TPP in. As I think the New Zealand negotiator put it, as long as we call it the Trump-Pacific Partnership, we'll be set, right?
How do you think the bilateral, U.S.-Japan bilateral, would do on the foreign policy?
Oh, I think the U.S. bilateral with Japan is an important part, and as I was saying before, I think this is a good way that China can try to play the Japan can play the China card. As you say, I think accurately, most of the TPP negotiations end up being U.S.-Japan negotiations, right? Because that was really real the point. And in fact, the U.S. could not even meet the Singapore standards of the P4. As you know, we wanted all sorts of exclusions in there. So I think it's great that the U.S. should have a bilateral agreement with Japan, given that TPP is not moving forward. I'm still a multilateral guy. I'm not a minilateral guy. I still remember the WTO. No one ever talks about it. I'm still a WTO fan. But then, you know, maybe I'm just old and quaint.
All right, let me bring other questions. Now from the back of the room, right at the yes, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Ken Scalby from Marbury Corporation. So my question is, do you think would be there any reaction or retaliation from the U.S. side if the Japan and the other 10 signatory countries of TPP try to achieve the TPP 11, and which might be affect the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and these 11 countries?
So if there could be a negative reaction from the United States.
I personally don't see that. I don't think the Trump administration is paying much attention to what Asians do. Frankly, go ahead and negotiate and they'll say, what? Oh, really, there's this agreement? What is it, you know? So that's my view. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, too. but point, as I mentioned, you know, U.S.-Japan bilateral relationship has a role of sort of easing sort of the concerns, both in Japan, particularly Mr. Abe, and also U.S., who actually had some visions on Asia. So I don't see any sort of retaliation or something like that what could come from the United States. But however, you know, Japan probably might overreact. So that's why the U.S.-Japan bilateral, well, FTA might be effective in this case in keeping a good relationship with the United States as much as possible.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm Jin Ninh Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. I would like to ask you further, Dr. Urata, and also all the Japanese doctors, regarding the relationship between Japan and Southeast Asian, especially the partners in the TPP, in view of you pushing forward for the TPP 11 or TPP 15, especially with Vietnam. What do you see the role of Vietnam in supporting Japan development in that area? I understand that today the Japanese emperor is visiting Vietnam, and Prime Minister Abe has had many positive efforts toward Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I would like to hear from you what Vietnam can do to support your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you.
as you know, Japan and Vietnam already has a bilateral FTA in addition to Japan-ASEAN FTA. So already we have a very close relationship. And one advantage of, say, Vietnam in the TPP, if TPP is realized, is this cumulative rules of origin, which Professor Fukagawa mentioned. You know, say, think about textile products. Textile yarn produced in Japan, sent to Vietnam, and then, you know, produce material and clothes and apparel. If that is shipped to the U.S., there's no tariff involved if TPP is enacted. So in that sense, Vietnam can play a very important role in connecting Japan and Vietnam and the U.S. And Japan, Japanese government realized the importance of Vietnam in that way. And also, like you said, Japan and Vietnam have a very good relationship. Emperor's maybe last overseas trip will take place in Vietnam. And having said this, I'm an economist, but I have to say something about maybe the relationship between China and Japan and Vietnam. Of course, you know, the relationship between Vietnam and China is maybe I don't have to explain. So for Japan, it's important to have a good relationship with Vietnam, kind of to put pressure on China. And so in that regard, I think Japan, Vietnam, TPP involving Japan and Vietnam will be very important.
I think one of the reasons why Vietnam has got so important in TPP for Japan is that Vietnam was regarded as a kind of a starting point for the domino effect to cover the whole ASEAN countries. Since Vietnam, as long as Vietnam remains in the TPP, that is going to pressure Thailand or Philippines, other participants, because of the competitions with Vietnam. And if Thailand just remained as it is, with the rising wage and the political instability, probably many companies will be continues to be attracted by Vietnam in terms of the low-cost manufacturing site. So if Vietnam is there, Thailand and Philippines has another geopolitics against China. So there was a calculation that Vietnam was a very crucial countries. And it's in terms of the rural origin, even Korea should be attracted by TPP because their China plus one production site is Vietnam. So as long as Vietnam remains there, since they are discriminated against the Japanese export to Vietnam, they've got to go. They've got to come to TPP. So Vietnam was a kind of starting point for the whole domino theories for Japanese strategies, but now it's all gone, so we have to calculate some another strategies.
Very good. There was a question from this gentleman. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have?
Okay. Well, just one point. You know, the significance of Vietnam to Japanese companies is, of course, you know, the much lower labor cost. And the TPP, you know, the inclusion was suddenly pushed to this, you know, the Japanese corporate interest, which we call China plus one strategy. Of course, plus one mainly means Vietnam. So now already, you know, trade diversion took place. You know, the company is shifting, you know, their factories and fibers and this kind of stuff, you know, textiles to Vietnam, so that, you know, those companies can export those products to United States for tax, for no tax, right? So I think the already companies are moving in considering the TPP's implementation. So I think Vietnam is playing a quite significant role in terms of the Japanese, you know, sort of the investment, Japanese companies' investment strategies.
Thank you. Now we can go.
My name is Gerald Rose. I'm the editor of the Executive Intelligence Review. I'm going to put something on the table, which gives us, it's been hinted at, it's been discussed a bit, but I want to put it on the table explicitly. I think we're in the middle of a scientific industrial revolution at this point. As everyone has mentioned here, China has lifted 700 million people out of poverty over the last 10 years or so. You're talking about physical economy now, which Japan has a genius on. And I'm saying that very directly. the need, it's not just infrastructure. We use the word infrastructure very loosely. We are talking now about rail lines that go from the coast of China through Pakistan, through Kyrgyzstan, through Kazakhstan, through up through all sorts of ports, maritime. The idea that somehow we have to divide a limited product as opposed to an industrial scientific revolution, including, and I know Japan is very interested in this, on the question of space. We now are on the verge, if we think about it right, if we don't play geopolitics, we can move into a whole new array, like we did when we went to the moon, a whole new array of products and potentials. So that's what I want to put on the table.
Thank you. Okay, Bernie.
Bernard Gordy, University of New Hampshire. I want to return to what Medea mentioned. I'm sorry. Thank you. Bernard Gordon, University of New Hampshire. Onata-sensei and Medea and Tanada have all said that the, if I understood correctly, that the possible next step is a bilateral relationship, the return to the notion of a bilateral U.S.-Japan FTA. But, and we've talked, you've talked about it several times. At the bottom line, do you think, particularly Urata-sensei and Tanada, do you think that it is too much of a bite for Abe to take on? Will that break? Because apparently, let me just say this, apparently that's what Trump will buy into, a bilateral. Is it too much for the Japanese negotiators to take on for that notion to succeed? Because if that notion doesn't succeed, I don't know, that I think maybe then we would have to recognize that any form of a TPP is not going to stay alive. Thank you.
Shall I respond to this?
Yes.
I don't think it's too much for Prime Minister Abe to take on. I think we can. I think Japan can accept this proposition coming, possibly coming from President Trump about, you know, bilateral FTA. And Japan should, like I said, accept this proposition, because that eventually will improve the competitiveness of Japanese economy. And you know, Vinnie talked about this so-called export restraint kind of policies, you know, which Japan, U.S. imposed on Japan. And that is very, that has very negative implication. But there are many results which came out from Japan-U.S., you know, bilateral kind of negotiations or debates and controversies, like opening up agriculture sector, beef market in Japan because of pressure coming from the U.S., opening up orange market, opening up cherry market. You know, these are at the kind of request or demand coming from, pressure coming from the U.S. And what happened to this market, the beef market in Japan? They became more competitive, stronger. Of course, there are many, you know, beef growers, beef farms, which went into bankruptcy. But those who survived became stronger. So, again, and I think Mr. Abe and his colleagues know the possible positive consequences of this market opening. So what I'm trying to say is that Japan is, I think, ready to accept this bilateral FTA proposition. And what I heard, I don't know how, you know, accurate or true to this is, but Japanese is getting ready. I mean, you know, they tried to come up with the better, I mean, what's the word? You know, in order to participate in TPP negotiation, Prime Minister Abe set up a TPP unit, special unit, kind of, right? And that was one of the success, I think. And now they may be thinking about firming up or coming up a better negotiation group to, you know, possibly deal with this Japan-U.S. FTA. So again, I think Prime Minister Abe can accept this proposition if it comes to him.
Okay, let me say a bit from different perspective. And Japan was not comfortable or happy with the result of TPP in terms of automobile liberalizations. It's all done bilaterally. It's not multilateral negotiations, only done by between Japan and the United States. And well, 25 years for just mere 2.5% tariffs on the American commercial cards, and also 25% for 30 years time period for liberalization on pickup truck, but nothing to Japanese automobile companies. Well, anyway, that's a good incentive for Japanese automobiles to continue to invest in the United States rather than exporting directly from Japan to the United States. But this is the point why Japan now become aggressive in terms of the negotiations with the European Union. Now EU-Japan FTA is something next if Japan wants to finish as soon as possible because of the TPP problem. And Japan is now hoping the European Union to eliminate tariffs on auto parts as soon as possible, probably immediately. And of course, some period of time, but it should be also eliminated on automobiles. It's about 10% on commercial cards. And this year, of course, election year for Europeans, France and Germany, even Dutch, but that probably doesn't produce so much automobiles. But that makes it quite difficult now for US, EU and Japan to conclude the bilateral negotiations on FTA. So in this case, if Japan-US FTA bilaterally were established, Japan might try to ask United States to make more concessions than US promised within the TPP framework. I know the many media in Japan focus on agriculture, America's more aggressive negotiation styles to get more concessions than they got from Japan. I think 80,000 tons, quarters of rice to Japan every year would be quite big, the deal the United States got. But nevertheless, still Japan protects some sectors like beef, as Professor Rato mentioned, in which the tariffs on for Australian beef has been reducing already. That discriminate against the American beef market, beef producers. But anyway, so I think the Japan should be more aggressive too, to get more concessions from US side, which I think should be more highlighted by Japanese media, and also Japanese negotiators should have more confidence in terms of the negotiations. But of course, this is only in my mind.
Okay, I think we have a Claude at the back.
Excuse me, Claude Barfield, AEI. I'd like to posit that we ought to maybe, and I don't know what's going to happen, but we ought to take these guys at their word, starting with Trump. And so it may very well be that they will go right through with what they said, or try to anyway. That is, that they are not interested in going beyond bilaterals. And so whether they will start with Mexico and Canada, then we'll go to Japan, and then go to Korea. They have always also said they want to renegotiate other trade agreements, other bilateral agreements that we have. So it's quite likely, and I say this because these are things that Trump has been embedded in his mind for decades. And so while we think that we hope that other more sensible people will come to the White House, when Navarro speaks, he speaks with Trump's mind right now to the degree that he has one. So we ought to assume that that's the kind of world that we'll be living in over the next, certainly for this administration. And it goes beyond just the bilaterals. I mean, in terms of Trump's desire or his definition of the success or failure of a trade agreement, it has to do with the trade surplus, the trade deficit. I think they will probably put that on the table and try to go back. We already heard that they are looking at ways of getting around the VER rules in the WTO. And looking at ways of just saying to the WTO, we will not go along with that, and it's too bad if you don't like it. So that my point is that it looks to me as if we ought to start out whatever we think and the panel, the panel thinks, assuming that, at least for the moment, they're going to go through with a lot of what he said during the campaign.
Thank you, Claude. I think that's a very useful point. And in my mind, I think that's why I think that maybe it would be in Japan's interest to take a wait-and-see approach and see how American negotiators in this administration flesh out what the position is going to be. And I think that negotiation that's coming first is going to be about NAFTA. And there's a lot to be learned there regarding whether it would be in Japan's interest. Because if it's really about liberalizing markets, we can all see the economic benefits. But if it's about embedding protection as part of this negotiation, then that wouldn't be in Japan's interest. And a failed negotiation, obviously, would be the worst outcome in terms of the bilateral relationship. So I very much sympathize with that sentiment. I don't know how the panelists feel.
Just one maybe question to maybe Fred or Claude. I'm just wondering, you know, like U.S. farm lobbyists, I mean, those are the ones who would benefit a lot from TPP. Currently, you know, Japan, Australia, FTA have given benefits to Australian farmers. Can we expect these American farmers to come to, you know, fore and then put pressure on the Trump, you know, administration about the, like, TPP?
All right. I know Fred and Claude both want to respond, so I'll give you the chance. Who has a microphone? Fred, do you mind if Claude goes first and then you because the microphone is... Okay, Claude.
For me or Fred?
Claude, you go first. Claude.
I think, yes, down the road, I do not doubt that the American political system, you know, the lobbying for the people who really support and are...
Can you speak a little bit?
I do not doubt that down the road there's going to be a reaction, whether it's the agricultural or some of the business community. But the president can do a lot before you can get to there. And so I think we'll just have to see how it plays out. But my only point is, and I don't know how, I'm not predicting this will happen, but you've got to realize that these are firm and fixed views, and these are people who actually believe in what they're doing. And they're going to have to go through some sort of reaction and some sort of economic reaction, I'm talking about, as well as political, before they will change. I don't think they're going to change just in terms of somebody going into the president's office or to Navarro's office and saying, you know, this is going to be disaster for us. They will work through it, I think.
You know, I'm much more optimistic than Claude on that. And that pushback is already occurring in a big way. I met just last week with the chiefs of staff of about 20 of the top senators. One of them said the following, very telling point. He said, Trump won 30 states. In 27 of those states, agriculture is either the first or second largest industry. The agricultural community thought that TPP was by far, the biggest policy initiative that would benefit agriculture and sees no alternative out there that's anywhere close. These were people who supported Trump and said, and if he doesn't deliver for us, we're going to leave him. So, and you've seen editorials by leaders of the agricultural community in the Wall Street Journal arguing very strongly in the same direction. So there is already a big backlash. We know there are battles within the White House, as well as within the administration more broadly. So I do not take it as given as much as Claude does. I mean, sure, there are a couple of people in the administration who have strong views. But Trump demonstrably changes his views overnight and in reverse direction. I mean, it's not even clear they're going to do anything about Obamacare now. Let alone trade policy. So the point is, as usual in the United States and Japan, any democracy, there's a big internal battle, particularly when major changes are proposed. What I think is important in the context of today's discussion is that our friends in other countries reinforce the pressure to push things in a constructive direction. So I've been a big fan of what Prime Minister Abe has been saying when he's visited President Trump twice now. Stick with TPP, but if that's the alternative, do a bilateral, but on the view, as you said, that it can be a stepping stone back to a regional agreement. And we know that kind of competitive liberalization frequently has happened. So I think it is very important. We've got an upcoming G7 summit in a couple of months, then a G20. These will be Trump's first initiatives in the multilateral diplomacy economic field. And it's very important that the rest of the world reinforce the tendencies to move back in constructive direction. I would stress, Trump has not done anything yet except, which was very bad, drop out of TPP. He's done nothing else yet, not even on NAFTA. So there's a lot of rhetoric. We know there are some restrictive advisors, but there are also a lot of other people. The Secretary of State has not weighed in yet. The Secretary of Treasury has not weighed in yet. We know the National Economic Council is pretty reasonable. So do not despair.
The only thing, just to end this, the only thing I would say is that he is highly popular in his own constituency.
Sorry, no, Clement, you have 1 minute if you want to say something really fast.
The only thing I would say is that all of this is true, and I hope Fred is right. But just remember what this has to it would be Congress you'd have to look to. The Congress is cowed by him right now because he is highly popular in the constituencies that he won. He's not popular in the rest of the country, but he doesn't really care about the rest of the country. And so I don't see anything in the party at the moment, including the leadership, would overturn anything he's done.
I do have to stop now. I think you can see what a critical juncture this is, that you have some of the brightest brains on trade diplomacy here sparring back and forth because we don't really know where we're going, and these are very serious topics. So I just want to ask you to please join me in thanking the panelists, and then we can carry on the conversation. Thank you very much.